Jodie, I wore this jumper for you, by the way.
It's a great, I love like an Aran sweater or a Guernsey sweater or, you know, all the hidden messages. And actually,
Hidden messages.
well, you know, in knitting, because we're talking about, you know, code messaging in flowers later on.
Oh,
But
yeah.
there's a whole area of jumper knits. The women would sew messages of hope and stuff into there, or knit messages of hope into their
That's cool.
fisherman husbands' jumpers and stuff. So.
I love that. Well, like even sewing like bits of blue ribbon into the hems of things for protection.
Yeah. Welcome, everybody, to episode 3 of Time for Tea 1903. This month, joined by Isabella Scott. Very exciting because we're talking about Macintosh and flowers and plants. And Isabella's mom is a florist. So that's going to be useful, I hope. So we're officially in spring. I thought it would be good to discuss plants and flowers and things of that ilk because Macintosh at the Willows and Art Nouveau building and Art Nouveau makes good use of natural forms. And also because of the crafting that's gone into the building, quite a lot of materials in the building, you know, originated from plants. You know, we've got wood in there, we've got different kinds of plants that form seating and stuff like that. So, and of course, it's Macintosh at the Willow. So we can talk about the willow tree as the central motif.
Absolutely.
So just before we start, as a sort of a warm-up intro, I thought I'd ask you, Isabella, if because we're all, you know, out on our walks still because of lockdown, have you spotted any flowers on your strolls? Have you seen anything peeping through?
When I do go out, I have noticed the snowdrops
Yeah.
and crocuses, which are
Yeah.
actually pretty like prevalent in Art Nouveau designs as well.
Do you think that's because they're easy to draw?
Don't be rude, Jodie.
I mean, they're beautiful, but maybe, you
Because
know,
they're easy
I
to
remember being a kid drawing a crocus and a snowdrop.
Yeah, that is true. I don't know. I think because we could say it's because they're easy to draw, or it could be the symbolism of rebirth, because that's kind of the craft, isn't it? The rebirth of nature after
Yeah.
this industrial revolution.
So, where have you seen these little buddies? Where have you seen these crocuses and snowdrops?
Kelvin Grove Park, because I have a tendency to go and feed the squirrels. How about you? What have you been seeing? What have you been viewing?
So I live in the south side of Glasgow, across the river. So I strolled up to Pollock Park, and there's lots of lovely trails in Pollock Park. If you've not been, it's a great park to walk around. And they're pathed trails, but there are also like signs that say woodland trail. But because everything's been like neglected because of lockdown, and there's no like gardeners looking after it, it's not a trail, Isabella. It's not a trail. It's a trail like in an Indiana Jones film, you know,
That's
like.
amazing. That's what I'd want.
So I set off on a trail which was supposedly called the Rhododendron Walk. And believe me, there were rhododendrons. I mean, they're beautiful, but they're quite invasive, I think, as a species. So I sort of hacked my way through and then just emerged and probably
Did you have a
scared.
machete?
I forgot to pack on my stroll to Pollock Park. I forgot to pack my machete. Lovely. So let's get going. Let's talk about Macintosh in the context of flowers. So I think a lot of people, a lot of listeners, and a lot of visitors to our building know him as an architect, right? And they perhaps also know him as an interior designer. But there was this whole other strand. There's a whole other artistic flourishing, really, in terms of his watercolors. He did a lot of painting of flowers and stuff. Did you experience Macintosh first through his buildings or through his paintings, or where do you come down on the Macintosh art spectrum?
I actually experienced it at GCSE through his more illustrative watercolors, because I actually used them as part of a project. And then obviously when I came to Glasgow, I started to experience his architecture more and enjoy it in that way. But I actually think that his watercolors are my favorite works that he does, because there's something a little bit lo well a lot looser about them, and they've got this proper, like, you know, when you can see someone's personality through their cartoon work or illustrative work, you feel like you can see his personality in a really big way through his kind of, because they're like slightly wobbly lines and just looser.
I think he did like over 100 flower drawings. So prepare to have your heart broken because apparently he only exhibited 7 and he only sold one.
Really?
And nowadays we regard his floral works, his botanic works as masterpieces, don't we,
Oh
really?
yeah, 100%.
They prove really popular in the shop and in books that have the colored plates of them. And I think you're kind of dead right about the style. There's something because he didn't do backgrounds, you know, he'd draw, or he'd, you know, colour the plant, but not put a context in. It's very much like a Japanese print again, like we talked about that influence of Japan on his style. It just means that the plant holds focus. You know, it's all about the details, the tiny little details of the plants. I love that, like you were saying, you know, when it came to like colouring them, watercolouring them, he'd go out of the edges or he'd not go chill. Off. You know, maybe it's the difference between when he was doing a building for Miss Cranston, for example, it was a commission. So there was always another person who had to sign off on designs. But when he was doing his sketches and watercolours, he was just doing them for himself.
And also they're obviously studies to, they're studies. So it's a way of building up his portfolio and practicing.
I'm just really glad that we've got them. I'm glad that we've got those watercolours and those sketches because obviously it shows us about his mastery of form. But I think it reveals a little bit about his personality as well, especially if we fast forward in his life when he and Margaret moved to France because he couldn't get any work. He'd been kind of, his architectural career was over and they were really struggling, that he had this, still had this artistic output. I find quite comforting, really. It's almost like, I know the phrase is going back to nature, but like he was literally going back to nature.
Well, he grew up in the house that he grew up in, there's quite a lot of writing about how his dad kept a really lovely garden that he liked to spend time in. We also know that when he was down south, when he was arrested on suspicion of being a spy, they found a lot of work that was addressed to a German location. And that was, I think that was some of his plant studies as well.
I'm glad you brought that up, actually. It's so interesting to think about like how the things we're exposed to really early on in life can influence us if we're, you know, if we work in an artistic field. Like a lot of people know that his dad was a policeman, but not a lot of people know that his dad as a hobby was a gardener. So McIntosh would have been exposed to gardening and plants, even though he was a, you know, a city kid. So yeah, it's fascinating to kind of think about that influence early on. So let's just tackle head on the fact that the building is called the Willow Tea Rooms. Can you explain to listeners a little bit about why it's called the Willow and how the willow as a motif kind of expresses itself throughout the building, culminating ultimately, I think, in the Salon de Luxe?
Socky Hall Street, the name itself derives from old Celt phrases, which mean alley of willows.
Yeah, that's right. Scots. It's Scots language.
Scots, yeah.
Which is a, you know, sidebar. It's an official language of Scotland. So that's pretty interesting, isn't it?
I wish I could talk that.
Yeah, so you find Scots, nowadays it's spoken quite a lot up on the East Coast. Doric is essentially a type of Scots. So you'd find it in like Aberdeen and like north of Dundee and up there. But there are a lot of Scots loanwords that have kind of drifted into Scots English. And then obviously we've got Gaelic as well. But yeah, so Isabella's right that it's a Scots word that's kind of crept into the naming of the street and then become an inspiration for the building.
Yeah, so throughout the whole building, you have stylized versions of this willow tree. So everything from the catkins and buds, green shoots, there's a lot of natural forms, but obviously the willow is the sort of overriding one. I think the most prevalent space that demonstrates this, except for the Salon de Luxe, would probably be the gallery. So when you walk through the front saloon towards the back saloon, the idea is that the back saloon looks up into this mezzanine called the gallery. The idea is that the back saloon is kind of like a dark undergrowth, like a forest floor, and that looks up into the mezzanine, which is supposed to represent a treetop canopy. Now in this space, you've got the columns that go upwards, and these columns have got lights hanging all around them. So they in themselves represent willow trees with like hanging heavy branches, which is amazing and super interesting. If you put it in the kind of architectural concepts of buildings, it kind of, I think it harkens back to potentially the idea or concept of a sacred grove, which was really important in mythology. This is just my interpretation of it, but it's quite interesting in terms of the idea of escapism within Art Nouveau. The sacred groves in mythology would link humans and gods. In sort of Greco-Roman temples, you have those pillars going upwards, and I believe that derived from the sacred grove, which would obviously be a grove of trees, and then you have your altar in there for sacrifice. The temples were basically a more sort of formal structuring of this outside of nature.
And Isabella's right, because like every 100 customers that would come in, Miss Cranston would sacrifice them, right?
On the altar.
Have you ever been to Paris? Have you been to Paris, Isabella?
I have.
So obviously one of the lovely things about going to Paris is the metro, is the Paris metro and the metro entrances, because they're really classic Art Nouveau, aren't they? Because they're metal, but they're kind of formed into plant shapes like leaves and vines and stuff. And in part, I think that was because people, it's hard for us to imagine nowadays, but people were really scared of the technology that was kind of appearing around them, like especially things like the underground, you know, a thundering steam train under your feet, like it's quite frightening. So if the gateway to this terrifying place actually is a bit softened because it seems to be like nature and forest and natural things, it kind of does a psychological trick for you. And I think, you know, maybe you could even argue that that's the case in things like Tiffany lamps as well. You know, it's electricity, it's new, so it may be a little bit scary, but the lamp itself is full of like plant shapes and natural things. So maybe it means don't be so scared of this. So tell us about the Salon Deluxe. Tell us about the water motifs in the Salon Deluxe and the willow.
Right, the Salon Deluxe is mint for many a reason. It's basically like a little glittering jewellery box. Again, it's supposed to transport you to another world. So it's just this idea of escapism. Obviously, as most of you guys will probably know, is based on a poem by Rossetti. Dante Gabriel Rossetti. Or is it Gabrielle? I can never tell. Gabrielle.
You know, because he was a bit of a charmer. I imagine that's how people introduced him when he walked in, when he swaggered into the room. They were like, Dante.
So at this part of the poem, you kind of imagine her, like the sort of personification of love almost floating at the top of this well, which is what we see in the gesso panel. And water and the feminine and the willow tree all have really strong connections to women, particularly in Celtic mythology, actually. So you've got just general mythology. So in mythology, basically, the willow is sacred to Hera, Hecate, Circe, Persephone, and they're all goddesses of the underworld. And in Celtic mythology, the willow represents the death goddesses as well. So there are darker undertones. And then throughout the actual room itself, you have references to water as well. So you have little droplets that are sewn into the paneling of the silk on the walls, which are representative of sort of dewdrops, of like the morning dew in this scene. And then even in the chandeliers, they're supposed to represent the kind of hanging of a willow, like the way that a willow tree would hang. But the baubles themselves have little bubbles of air put through them to refract the light and to make this sort of make the room itself glow a little bit warmer and stuff. But that also looks like air bubbles coming through water. So it probably represents these brimming kisses at the surface of the water bubbling. So it's been done really well. I know I always say this, but I'm just like, damn woman. She knew what she was doing. She's got an eye for detail.
Yeah, that the she being Margaret MacDonald. So in Celtic mythology, watery places like rivers and ponds and lakes, they're what we call liminal spaces. Yeah, liminal meaning like a in-between space, essentially. Yeah,
like almost like a portal between two worlds.
Exactly, like a portal, like a magical place or a door between one place and another. Places of transformation, really. And I think it's fascinating that Margaret MacDonald and McIntosh kind of really used those ideas associated with the willow of transformation, life and death, you know, the border between life and death. But also that as a customer, when you come or when you came in 1903, but even nowadays, because the Salon Deluxe is such an incredible space, so different than where you've just come from, it is a transformative space, isn't it? You are leaving one world and entering another, essentially like a fairy tale world or a mythical world. So it seems right to me that they've used water and the willow, the tree associated with water, to kind of capture that feeling. Do you know anything about willow out with myth? Do you know what do you know anything about medicine and willow? Because this is
maybe
in the olden days, in days of yore, suppose you had like a headache or a toothache,
get yourself a bit of tree bark.
That's right,
that and some tea and you're absolutely laughing.
Get chewing on the willow, because that's where aspirin came from originally. Isn't that interesting?
How's your tea, by the way, Jody? How's
Yeah, normally we talk about it at the beginning, but I've just kind of ploughed on. Yeah, so we're drinking Scottish chai this month. Pekoe tea, Scottish chai. I've enjoyed it. I've drunk it all. I didn't have any milk, but I was uncertain if I should put milk in it or not. Isabella.
What milk in mine?
Did you put milk in yours?
I'm not sure if it was a good idea, if I'm honest with you.
Did you enjoy it?
We live and we learn. I'm still enjoying it, yeah.
I think it's a good idea. If you enjoyed it, I think that's the measurement of tea. So, you know, we don't make aspirin out of willow anymore, but, you know, that's where it came from.
Speak for yourself, Jody.
The other thing that willow is used for is basket weaving. So, like, in the 18th century, Isabella, if you wanted to if you just pick some hazelnuts and you wanted to take them to your friend, don't know why you'd be doing that. That's an odd thing to do. But suppose you were a hazelnut gatherer. I wish I'd given you a different job, but never mind. You might use you might make your basket out of willow because it's bendy, right? It's flexible. Yeah. So it's really good for basketry, really.
Willow basket.
Which leads me on to talking about another material in another plant that we find in the tea room, actually. So if we leave the Salon de Luxe for a moment and then stroll up the stairs to the billiard room, to the gentleman's room, the men's room. The billiard room has these lovely booths and they've got rush seating on them, rush pads. So that's made from rush, which is a plant. In Scots, it's called floss, which is nice. Well, I wish we'd still called it floss, but
we don't call it floss.
And floss or rush is another water plant as well. So it's very interesting to think that, you know, Margaret MacDonald and McIntosh were thinking about materials that kind of were associated with each other. Again, it's quite flexible. The rush seating's all been done by hand. Now, I might be wrong, but I think that the lovely lady who did them for us said it took a day each seat pad. So it's a very labor-intensive material to use, but, you know, we wanted to create the same effect as they had in 1903 when these things were made by hand. So it's rush seating when you come visit and plonk your derriere down. You're sat on floss on rush there. And speaking of furniture, of course, we've got all McIntosh's lovely chairs throughout the building, all handmade. And they're made of oak. It's very interesting because, you know, going back to talking about Celtic mythology, Isabel, do you know anything about like the Celtic tree alphabet and Ogham? Yeah. Scotland's native trees, a lot of them end up in this thing called the tree alphabet. So, you know, we're going way back in time to the time of the Druids and Ogham, the kind of secret language where a tree represented a letter in the alphabet. So oak appears there, you know, as the letter D, and it would be carved on a stick or on a stone, on a standing stone or something with a certain kind of shape. And if you were of that time period, you could read the Ogham, you would know that that meant oak, but also that it meant the letter D. And willow appears as one of the tree alphabets as well. So I guess it just makes me think about Margaret MacDonald and the Spook School and her sister's kind of total immersion in Celtic mythology. And, you know, that they would be drawing or certainly subconsciously thinking in terms of myth and legend and representation and symbolism and things like that.
But it is nice that these little bits and pieces were sort of woven throughout the building. Again, everything was thought of so carefully.
Yeah. Could you, Isabella, because I do want to take advantage of your mum, basically. I want to exploit for your mum a little bit. Because Isabella's mum's a florist. And Isabella's mum designed for the tea room a lovely floral arrangement in the Salon de Luxe. So could you say a little bit about the our friend, the old snake's head frittata, the snake's head?
I can't say it. What is it a frittataria?
So what we are attempting to do, but failing terribly, is we are attempting to say the proper name of a flower that McIntosh first did as a watercolor, but now appears in our building. I've got it as snake's head fritillary.
Right, I'm just going to go right in there and say that it's a tulip with squares on it. So I'm going to call it the squared tulip, right?
Squared tulip. All right, so tell us about the squared tulip.
So so Mam did a couple of floral arrangements for the tables in the Salon de Luxe, and it was inspired by the room. And she used this little squared tulip in it as well, which is fantastic because one of McIntosh's most famous watercolors, well, in my opinion, is one of, I think it's Fritillaria?
Well, I'm just going with frittata because, you know, that's all I can say.
She's done really well with it because initially there would have been, I mean, in the old pictures of the Salon de Luxe, it was peonies, I think, but it's nice to give it, freshen it up a bit. But yeah, so silk flowers from Great British Bash, you heard it here.
Plug, little plug. Yeah, so, but it's so lovely that, you know, if we do the timeline of it, that McIntosh sat down in front of one of these snake's head flowers and took the time to sketch it and then colour it with watercolours. And for him, it was going to be a watercolour. And it's become inspiration for actual flowers again in the building. So it's kind of got a nice like life cycle on it.
Yeah, lovely.
And I think you're right. It's one of his most famous paintings, and it's a beautiful one as well. It's a really iconic watercolour. And you do find the plants around. They're not native to Scotland, but people would grow them here and there. And I suppose So I was thinking about Miss Cranston and her garden, because one of the lovely things about the building is that, you know, Miss Cranston would bring flowers in from her garden in its hill and put them in the baldacchino. So, you know, the seasons would be passing. Mm-hmm. And at first I was wondering if she would bring in native flowers, but actually thinking more carefully about it, she was a Victorian and she had a wee bit of money, and the Victorians were obsessed with gardening, but, you know, glasshouse gardening, like exotic flowers, things were coming in, seeds were coming in on boats and plants were coming in. So, you know, there was that huge explosion of fancy gardening. Like we have the botanic gardens up in the West End, don't we? So I wonder if Miss Cranston was, you know, growing all sorts of crazy plants here and there. We don't know.
Why would she have had time for that, Jodie? She's not.
Well, it doesn't take that long. Maybe she had a wee gardener anyway. But I was trying to find out if her house in Knits Hill had some greenhouses. But unfortunately, there's only one or two pictures left of the house, which has been demolished. But I suspect it did, because it was a big phase, a big fad for Victorians to grow exotic plants and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Flowers in general. Often in Art Nouveau work, they would use perennials and shrubs to adorn sort of the walls, because those are what you'd see in a garden.
Yeah, and I mean, let's be honest as well, like the Art Nouveau embracing of nature produce some really beautiful stuff, right? I love seeing the plant forms in the building, like in the banisters and the balustrades going up to the gallery. There are, like, you know, stained glass that actually is shaped like a bud that's about to open, like about to burst open. You know, there's they just look full of life, don't they?
Yeah, they're awesome.
One of the things that I read that really tickled me was a report that, so James McNair, who was a friend of McIntosh's, you know, in that group, and also he worked with him at Honeyman and Kepi in the architects firm. James McNair had said that, like, McIntosh was not above, like, if he saw a twig or a plant that he liked, he was not above, let's just say, acquiring it. So I love the idea that McIntosh would be
just stealing it.
You'd be walking along the street and he'd have to turn around and be like, "Oi, Charles, what are you doing?" And he'd be like clambering over a fence to,
"I'm thieving these perennials."
Yeah, you know, the true artistic spirit there, really. If you are interested in finding out more about McIntosh and his botanical works, there's a really good book by Pamela Robertson, who was one of the people who helped us make sure that the McIntosh at the Willow Building was accurate. So Professor Robertson.
Shout out to Professor Robertson.
She wrote a book about McIntosh and flowers as well. So, you know, you can get that from your library or buy it from an independent bookshop as well. It's really lovely. And also the Hunterian holds the botanical prints, so you can go and have a nosy at them online or in person when the Hunterian reopens as well. So we've talked about how, you know, how lovely plants are and how they lift your mood and stuff. But Isabella, the Victorians, they were always, you know, they had some darkness in them when it came to flowers as well. So let's finish up by going back in time to 1903. It's our special slot where we learn something about what was going on in 1903. I thought we better finish off by having a wee chat about what a friend of mine called the Victorian insult bouquet, but I feel like that's just a small slice, isn't it? So the language of flowers, which was really big for Victorians at the time.
Floriography.
What did you find out? What did you learn through your little trawl through Victorian flower language?
Right. Well, I mean, it's, I don't know if you know this, but the Victorians weren't able to sort of like text someone and be like, "Listen, do you want to go out and get a pint? Or do you want to go on a date? Or just, I fancy you." So what they would do is send bouquets of flowers. So flowers were sent to convey personal messages that could not be spoken out loud. It was a way of being kind of secretive. But then I guess if they all knew about it, you would see a bouquet arriving and being like, "Oh, that's a creepy message."
Well, you would, but what the message was, you know, you'd have to go run to your bookshelves to get your Language of Flowers decoding book out, like in World War II, you know, with the decoding machines and the Enigma machines, because...
Then even so, like, if you've got a collection of flowers that someone sent to you and you're like, is it supposed to be a message? And it's got a complete sort of convoluted mixture of different messages. How are you supposed to know for sure?
I know, especially if you've not got the decoding book, right? So so I had a look at some flowers and meanings, and I assume you've done that as well.
I have.
because obviously if you're a Victorian, it's very hard to say like, I am your captive. If that was your message, I don't know why that would be, love captive. I think it means like, captivated. Instead of saying I'm captivated by you, which you couldn't do because, you just couldn't. Apparently you'd send someone a sprig of peach blossom.
That's nice.
But that just made me think about the emoji, the peach emoji, which.
Yeah, which is less wholesome.
Less wholesome. But, maybe emojis are just the 21st century version of Victorian bouquets. Because, if you don't know what an aubergine means, it's much like not knowing what a peach blossom means in Victorian times. So tell me about some Victorian messages that you could send through flowers. What have you got?
Right. So I was saying about rhododendron, which is I ne'er will see your face again, which is obviously the kind of wording that we would use today. My personal favorite was the a sprig of basil literally just means I hate you.
I mean, if you didn't have your decoding book, how would you know? Because basil's quite nice, isn't it? It's quite useful.
Going over to someone's house and you're just like, I know that I don't really want to go, but I'm going to be polite, or it's a thing that you're doing in your friendship group or your family, just take them a basil plant. And then realistically, what you're saying to them is, I hate you. But they never know.
But isn't it awkward? If you delivered it yourself, it would be awkward though, because they might know immediately what it means. So you just stand there with your basil plant and then...
No, just be like, I got this for you, focaccia.
And then run off.
Love you, bye. Or if you get sent some cornflowers, it means be gentle with me. And I was like, oh, God.
So is that something you give to like your dentist before? So if you thought that someone was being haughty, you'd send them a sunflower, which I think kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
I like it.
Big, tall, attention-grabbing sunflower. I mean, some of them are so cruel. Meadow sweet, uselessness. You're just useless.
God. Yeah, that's brutal. It's very, I'd rather someone just say I hate you.
I think it's very passive-aggressive, isn't it, this bouquet, this flower sending. So one of the things I was thinking about when I was, reading about this Victorian language of flowers was kind of what you said, like you would have to know how to decode the messages. So you would need like one of these books, and there were loads of them around that people would buy, sort of like not self-help books, but I suppose in that vein of like understanding what people are trying to tell you, psychology books. Yeah. And also if you wanted to reply, you would have to have the flowers at hand, right? So. Yeah. There was a whole industry of like, how do you, I just think it's quite tricky. Like for Miss Cranston, she wants to send one to the baker to say, your work is a great disappointment to me. So she'd have to go to the greenhouse and find the flowers that meant that. And what if she didn't have them? How is she going to do it? There's a lot of labor and thought that has to go into using this as a coded message system.
Yeah, I imagine that there'd be regional restrictions on the kind of plants that you could find as well.
Right. Like if I said to you now, like, Isabella, can you go out and get a sunflower?
And I would say anything for you, Jody. I'll be 15 minutes. And then you'd be really disappointed. For them to
see, but I remember that time when you had to dash out to get flowers for the roof terrace. And it was a palaver, wasn't it? It was like, Tesco, Marks and Spencer's, where are we going? How much money have we got?
I know, I got just an array of cactuses.
Cactus, that's the 21st century. That's all we can get now is cacti. I mean, having said that, there's a lot of stuff involved in these bouquets. I was reading that perhaps we've misunderstood it a little bit, and perhaps it was just like a parlor game that people played, because now we've described it, it does sound like a crazy way to live your life, doesn't it? Crazy, really. I think Miss Cranston would just send a note to the baker being like, boy, buck your ideas up, otherwise I'm going to find another supplier. But even as a parlor game, maybe it's a parlor game, that Victorian women sat around and tried to decode the flower. I'm not sure it would catch on nowadays. Maybe it would.
I like it.
Everyone else has
flowers.
Yeah, but could it compete with like Fortnite?
Could it? Pokemon Go? I don't think so, no.
I don't think so either.
It's a shame, really, isn't it?
But it's interesting anyway, in a way. Anything that Victorians do is kind of interesting as a sort of little window into their world. Obviously, we have plants we have fresh flowers in the tea room, which is lovely. But one of the newest spaces that we've opened up is the roof terrace, and that's going to be open to the public as soon as we can reopen. It's a lovely sun trap up there, and long term it would be lovely to actually have some like proper plants up there, some tubs, some things growing, to be able to pay homage to the fact that Miss Cranston used to grow stuff that found its way into the tea rooms.
Definitely.
So that's about that's about us all wrapped up. Thank you very much, Isabella, for sharing all your knowledge. Thank you, everybody, for listening to our interesting slash rambling discussion of Macintosh and plants and how they feature in the building and the Art Nouveau ethos as well. As always, if you've got any comments or any thoughts or anything you want us to have a wee look into for you about the history of the building, we're more than happy to do so. You can check in with us on social media or on the website as well. So on the podcast page, there's a wee box for comments. We look forward to welcoming everyone to the building in May when we reopen, so you can come and see these lovely plant forms yourself. And we will see you, but not see you because it's a podcast, next time.
Thanks, guys.